Great to be here this evening to have you back with us so we can study from the pages of God's Word on some very important issues. Particularly in our day and time at this juncture in our history, and with so many things going on in our country, both in terms of physical violence being perpetrated against innocent people, in terms of disasters of a natural nature, hurricanes and earthquakes and things like that. It's sometimes good for us to pause and reflect upon some basic questions that are often raised in connection with this. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why does it seem that every time I turn around, something bad is happening to me? It's almost as though sometimes people are blaming God for the difficulty that they incur in life. And sometimes when we look at the presence of evil, pain, and suffering in our world around us, we recognize that it is a reality. It cannot be denied. We can't simply say, well, what do you mean, evil, pain, and suffering? I don't see any. But it is around us, and we are reminded of that grim reality on almost a daily basis. And if we live long enough, we face it ourselves, because it is, after all, appointed unto man once to die, and after that comes the judgment, according to Hebrews 9, verse 27. So how do you make sense of all of this? And more importantly, how does somebody who believes in God, somebody who's a Christian, explain or make reason out of the fact that there is evil in the world today, that there is suffering, there is pain? Is God responsible for that? If God is all-powerful and all-loving, how do you explain its continued existence? And so the atheist preys upon the questioning mind and the person who is struggling with these matters, and basically argues, as did the ancient philosopher Epicurus in the 4th century A.D. And this is basically what he said, and it's really basically what people say today. He said, if there is a God who has the desire to prevent evil but cannot, he is not omnipotent, all-powerful. That is, he is not God. If there is a God who has the power but not the desire to prevent evil, then he is not omnibenevolent, because any good God would not want a world filled with these things. Therefore, if there is a God who has the power and desire, why then is there evil, pain, and suffering in the world today? And that basically, and it summarizes the argument that so many try to put upon people today. And the young, malleable minds that fill our nation's universities across the country are often presented with this argument by their professors or teachers in one class or another. And many, many of our young people are persuaded to turn their back on the faith of origin in which they had been raised. And so we need to turn our attention to those arguments and take a little bit of a look at them this evening. We'll be sort of skipping around a little bit and kind of editing as we go for sake of time. But how do you deal with those arguments? First of all, we cannot deny that there is evil, pain, and suffering in our world today. In the light of current events reported every day across our nation's news outlets of various kinds, we're left to face the bitter reality of the fact that we live in a world that is very much messed up. Something is not working right in the world today. And if we scratch our head a little bit, we might be able to figure out what that is in relationship to the fact that God is our creator and we are his creation, and we have largely forgotten him and turned away from him. But something's messed up in our world today, and even religious people, even in the church sometimes, can get discouraged, can wring their hands in despair and suggest that, well, I don't know what's going on. It just seems like things are worse than they have ever been before, and that we may very well, some suggest, be in the end times. And just a matter of a few days or weeks and everything will all be over. But I would ask this question, how do we know that would be the case? How do we get that kind of information? Because Jesus said, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Matthew 24, verse 36. We don't know the day or the hour of Christ's return. That same chapter goes on in verse number 44, and Jesus warns us that we ought to be ready always, because as he put it, he is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Paul described it as coming like a thief in the night. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 2. So maybe our premature discouragement at times is explained by the nature of modern day news. It is so rapidly and forcefully brought to our attention that we are not left with any time to wait. It's right there before us. And up-to-date news bites can sometimes leave false impressions because they don't always give the full context, historically or in the event itself. And we are left to think that this is a matter of doomsday prediction. I think maybe if I can make a quick aside here, I think this is especially illustrated by coverage of hurricanes. The news media must thank God every day for hurricanes, because these things come so far in advance that you can really build up for them. And I'm not saying they're not serious. They are serious. But wouldn't you like to have the job of standing out on the seashore waiting for the hurricane to come, and then to have your picture on the 6 o'clock news? Well, it's not here yet, but we're expecting it any time. And next time they show you, you're in your winter jacket and you're got your rain gear on, and it's raining. Yep, it's raining all right. And look, here's the waters coming. Well, this is the way the news media works. They build things up and they leave an impression. And sometimes those things are very, very destructive. And we want to know what's going on. But it's built for the news, because a tornado happens too quickly, usually in the night. And usually it's gone and there's nothing to go see live in person. But those events, those hurricanes, are very destructive. And I'm thankful that our elders have decided that we would send some funds and that others could join in sending funds to help with the cleanup and that sort of thing that is always left behind. This last week in Las Vegas, the horrible tragedy of some man who, we can only imagine what was going through his mind, if his mind was at all functioning properly. And what we will remember, aside from the nearly 60 lives that were lost and the many people who were injured, is the headline repeatedly, "The worst massacre in U.S. history." And I think that's what we're going to remember, at least until another one comes along. And I suppose in some respects that of course is true. I was thinking about something though when I heard that. 9/11 marks not only the anniversary of what happened at the World Trade Center and the destruction of those buildings, but it also marks an event which occurred in 1857 in the state of Utah, or the territory of Utah probably back then, when a wagon train from northwest Arkansas was passing through Mormon territory and were attacked by the Mormons. The wagons quickly circled themselves in a position of defense and were sieged by the Mormons on that occasion. It's a question as to whether or not Brigham Young actually ordered it or not. Some people think he did, some think he did not. But there was some negotiations and a settlement was reached, and the people promised that they would turn over their firearms in exchange for safe passage through the territory. And as soon as they turned their firearms in, they were massacred, men, women, and children, 120 to be precise, twice the number as in last week's Las Vegas shooting. Now, there may be some differences, of course, the one being a group of people doing the massacring and the other an individual, a lone gunman. But these things happen, and sometimes we wonder why. They certainly, without a doubt, are examples of evil, pain, and suffering that will go on in our nation's history. But you might be able to come up with other examples like this. But every day we encounter news about man's inhumanity to man. We have a crazy leader over in North Korea, affectionately known as the Rocket Man. We have a constant supply of bloodthirsty terrorists from the Middle East and all around the world threatening bad things. When have things ever looked so bad as they are right now? Well, keep a broad perspective. In the days of World War II, Adolf Hitler killed 6 million Jews. And most of us remember that or are familiar with that. Between 1924 and 1953, 20 to 30 million people were killed in Russia during the regime of Joseph Stalin. That's 20 or 30 million. Between 1949 and 1975, 40 million people were killed in the People's Republic of China during the days of Mao. Between 1975 and 1978, the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia brought about the deaths of 1.6 million people. And so you keep things in perspective by looking at these things, and you have plenty of examples of man's inhumanity to man. That doesn't even include the tortures and the imprisonments and the other types of atrocities that were performed. And if you go beyond the actions of man and look at natural disasters, the modern day hurricanes, though very destructive and doing millions and millions of dollars of damage, how do they compare to the 1556 Shanghai earthquake in China, which killed 830,000 people? Or the explosion of Mount Tambora in 1815 that killed 92,000 people in Indonesia? You probably don't remember, but I've heard stories about the 1918 global flu pandemic or epidemic, whatever the right word is there, killed 50 million people across the world, the flu. More recently, and I remember this, 2004, when the tsunami in the Indian Ocean brought about the deaths of 230,000 people. We're not trying to minimize recent destruction, but we are trying to give a broad perspective of the fact that there is pain and suffering in the world. It always has been that way. Probably always will be that way. But it's not necessarily an indication that the end time is upon us. But we do want to be able to answer, to be able to give some reason for the existence of evil, pain, and suffering to the one who is using that as supposed evidence that there is no God. I always thought it was funny that the atheist would argue that there cannot be a God because why did God allow these things to happen? They don't believe in a God, but they argue, why would God allow this to happen? As though they believed in a God. It just seems counterproductive. So let me give you some explanations. I'm just going to hit a few of the highlights here. When you're talking to somebody about these things, the first thing we have to examine is this. God has given us freedom of choice. Freedom of choice. Because He loves us. And because love necessitates that. How loving could a God be who created humanity without the freedom to choose? Here is your law. Here's what you must do. And that you have no choice in the matter, one way or the other, you automatically do it like so many robots. God is love, 1 John 1, chapter 4, verse 8. Love allows freedom of choice, and therefore God allows freedom of choice. Joshua, near the end of his time upon this earth, in the 24th chapter of Joshua, in addressing the people, challenged them, saying, "If it is right in your, if it is disagreeable rather in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." As an illustration of the fact that God has given us freedom of choice, we can choose to follow Him, or we can choose not to follow Him. And if we have that freedom of choice, then certainly others will have the freedom of choice as well. We've also been given, in conjunction with freedom of choice, instruction on how to regulate freedom of choice. And that's what we call the Scriptures, the Bible. God has given us freedom of choice, but He's also given us the instructions about how to regulate that. If God stepped in every time we started to make a bad decision and kept us from doing that bad thing, where is freedom of choice? There would be none whatsoever. If every action we took, whether good or bad, had the same result, how could we ever learn to appreciate what's right and to avoid what's wrong? You simply will not learn that way. Imagine trying to raise your child up, and if they did something good, you gave them a swat on the behind. And if they did something bad, you gave them a swat on the behind. They'd spend their whole life just kind of like, well, what is? You know, nothing makes any sense anymore. And that's really where we're at here. God has given us freedom of choice, and He has set His instructions in order in such a way that we can learn to do good and learn to avoid bad. There are rewards for the positives, and there are consequences for that which is negative. Peter illustrated this in 1 Peter chapter 4. He said, "Make sure that none of you suffers," and then he goes on and says, "as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler." He didn't say, "Let none of you suffer," period. He said, "Let none of you suffer for doing bad things." Well, bad things happen when we do bad things? Yes. If you practice these things, there are consequences in this life and in the life which is to come. So, we've been given freedom of choice. And sometimes we suffer when we make wrong choices. If I choose to go against God's way, there may be consequences to that. If I commit murder, if I steal something, I might eventually be caught and arrested and thrown into jail. I might lose my job. I might lose my family. I'll lose my freedom. All that suffering is a result of a freedom of choice and making the wrong choice. Sometimes we suffer, however, because of the wrong choices of other people. This is where sometimes people get confused. We're not saying that every time somebody suffers, they've done something wrong. That would be incorrect. Job's friend said, "Job, you're suffering because you did something wrong." That's wrong. That's not what was going on there. Sometimes suffering comes because we make wrong choices, and other times it comes because other people make wrong choices. How many people have died over the years because of personal wrong choices among a few evil men? Think of all the wars that have been fought. The casualties, both militarily and in the civilian realm as well. 37 million in World War I. 56 million World War II. 1.2 million in the Korean War. 3 million approximately in Vietnam. Aside from all of these deaths, there also are the unspeakable atrocities connected to such wars as these. Think about the wrong decisions and choices of others. Think about the fact that thousands of people die every year because someone made the choice first to drink alcohol and then secondly to drive their car while they were intoxicated. Thousands of people die. Half of the deaths on our nation's highway have something to do with that. And when that happens, and when it comes home to our own families, then it is very difficult for us to understand. Why didn't God step in and stop that from happening? It isn't fair. Well, life isn't fair. Would we have God take away our freedom of choice? Well, no. Is it okay for us to have freedom of choice, but us and us alone? No. Scripture says that God does not show partiality. Acts 10, verse 34. In every nation, the one who fears him and does what is right is acceptable in his sight. So God has given us freedom of choice. And if he's given it to you, and he's given it to me, he's given it to everyone. Love demands that. But the fact is, some make wrong choices, and as a result, we suffer for it. So what do you do about it? How do you protect yourself? I think there are some suggestions we might make. First, we have to trust God. We have to prepare ourselves for the next life. Be ready always for the eventuality that we may suffer and die. That something may happen that takes us from this life. But we need to be ready for the next life, right? In the scriptures, in Titus chapter 2, Paul describes that life, saying that the grace of God has appeared, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, and to live sensibly and righteously and godly in this present age, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God. So you think about what Paul said there, and we realize that there is a pattern for our lives to live sensibly, righteously, and godly, to avoid ungodliness. Take the good news to the world so that one by one, people are educated into making good choices. That's the direction that we need to take. Now, sometimes we suffer for the wrong choices of others. And then in the third place, sometimes we suffer for the wrong choices that have been made many, many years ago. That doesn't sound very fair, does it? But that is, in fact, the truth. We enjoy the benefits of things that have happened in past generations. Why would we expect not to receive the consequences of negative decisions and choices? For example, most of you probably rode in an automobile to services tonight. Well, those were invented really before my time, believe it or not. But I'm still enjoying the fruit of that innovation or that invention, right? The positives come along the way. You might fly in an airplane, and you might say, well, you know, some of us were not alive when that was happening either, believe it or not. But these things have passed down through time, and we enjoy the blessings. We can also expect that we will suffer the consequences of negative choices from time to time. Did God make us just to die? I don't think so. Look at the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3 and the description of the garden in those early chapters of the Bible. You see that Adam and Eve had access to the tree of life. I don't know what that tree looked like exactly. But if I understand things correctly, it indicates to me that by partaking of the tree of life, they could live forever in the paradise of God. Now, when they sinned and partook of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as they had been forbidden from doing, then they were cast out of the garden, and access to the tree of life was taken away from them, and death entered into the world because of their wrong choices. And according to Romans 5, around verse 12, death spread to all men because all have sinned. So we all have a part in that. But what he's saying then is that personal wrong choices made even as far back as Adam and Eve resulted in expulsion from the garden, access denied to the tree of life, and now we are in a world that has fallen. And in this fallen world, there's death. And connected with death is suffering and sickness and pain and sorrow and all of those things that are just kind of connected around death. But even in the beginning, God planned to plan and scheme to scheme and purpose to purpose that through his Son coming into the world, one day we would have access once again to the tree of life. And we read about it in the book of Revelation It's there in heaven waiting for us, the tree of life. Access which will be forever unhindered, and we will live forever and ever in that paradise of God. But the sins of the past affect the present. By the time of the flood in Genesis chapter 6, we read that the thoughts and intentions of man had become only evil continually. Chapter 6, verse 5. In verse number 6 and 7, it says that the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart, and the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to the birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. Imagine the heartbreak of our Creator in realizing that his creation had chosen the wrong path. He made them with the ability to choose, and they chose the wrong way. And the flood came as a result of their choices. And how does that affect us today? Well, I believe that if you would examine the cause of modern day disasters like hurricanes and thunderstorms and tornadoes and even earthquakes, you'd have to realize that it has to do with the geophysical condition of our planet. And if you asked a serious question about how does the physical makeup of our planet, how is that created? How is that made the way it is today? I think the answer is in the flood. Everything changed after the flood. Everything changed prior to the flood versus after the flood. And so these things brought about many of these situations that we experience today. Is it fair? We might say, no, it's not fair. That we should have a tornado come and hit our house, or have a hurricane come and decimate our possessions. That's not something we anticipate. But it's part of living in a fallen world. And it explains the existence of evil, pain, and suffering. Sometimes it has to do with the bad choices of people that they have made years and years ago. A number of times in the Bible, there is an expression that sometimes catches people off guard. You have it in the giving of the Ten Commandments. You have it in other places in the Bible as well. God describes himself both positively and negatively. But in the negative sense, he says that he will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations. You look at that and go, He's going to punish the iniquity of the fathers upon their great-grandchildren and great-great, down to the third or fourth generation? That doesn't sound very fair. But sometimes that's what happens in this fallen world. We do not inherit sin or the guilt of sin from our fathers or forefathers. But sometimes we inherit the consequences. A father who is thrown into prison because of poor choices he makes may leave his children without a parent, without adequate financial resources, and they suffer for his sins, but they're not guilty for his sins. And so children do often suffer for their parents' poor choices. Let me give you another example and we'll move on. According to Colossians, the first chapter around verse 23, the Bible says that the whole world had heard the proclamation of the gospel. In one generation, Paul said, the gospel has been spread throughout the whole world. Now, that doesn't mean that the gospel was accepted by the whole world or that everybody received the gospel, but it had been preached. Some rejected it, and they preferred instead to follow after their own will and own teachings. In fact, the book of Romans begins with a sort of a blanket condemnation of the Gentile world at that time. Paul spoke of those who exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for the image and the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures, verse 23. And then down in verse 25, he says that these exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Now, what's that have to do with what we're talking about? Transport yourself into modern-day India or some other place in the world. And sometimes you'll find cultures and situations across the globe. Had at one time these people been beneficiaries of the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ, according to Colossians 1:23, there had been that influence at one time. But instead, these Far Eastern religions, many of them, and some other types of religions, instead will worship the creature rather than the Creator. And so you'll have the masses of people living in squalor, children dying of starvation, when a food source like a cow or some other animal is running around in the streets and they could grab it and eat it or use it in some way to feed themselves, but they won't because they have accepted the idea that these creatures are the reincarnation of their former ancestors. Now, this has been passed down from generation to generation to generation. So, if we were to extrapolate backwards to the time when they heard the gospel, someone, somewhere, heard about Jesus Christ, were given the opportunity to believe in the God of the Bible, rejected that in preference to these kinds of teachings, which probably evolved through the years to now, look at their children, their grandchildren, their great-great-great-great-grandchildren, and how they are suffering because of a poor decision made generations and generations ago. I think you can see that this is something that happens all around us. Why the presence of evil, pain, and suffering? Sometimes it's just because, hey, you're at the wrong place at the wrong time. You find yourself in violation of natural law. The branch upon which you were climbing in the tree broke. And the force of gravity takes over and you're going to hit the ground hard. When you violate natural law, there are consequences. A pilot of a 747 may punch in a program to file a navigational plan for his airplane and may mistakenly punch in the wrong program or something, and I'm sure they have fail-safe things now, but they may do something that results in the crash of an airplane. Forgot about the fact that that course has a mountain right in the way and the airplane will fly right into it. Well, there's pain, evil, and suffering in the world today because of natural law. Even the day of Jesus Christ in Luke chapter 13, Jesus mentioned 18 upon whom the Tower of Siloam fell and killed. Why? Because of the law of gravity. When it fell, they were underneath it and they died. Natural law is sometimes violated unknowingly. I remember my dad when he went into the service, and others have told me the same thing, that one of the things they gave you as soldiers was lots and lots of cigarettes. At that time, you didn't know that they would hurt your health, and so everybody had them, and you did the smoking, okay? And now we know, of course, that's injurious to our health, and that promotes lung cancer and heart disease and all kinds of other things. But there may have been a time when someone got into that unknowingly, and this is sort of a natural law. This particular substance doesn't go with the human body, and it produces devastating effects. Other things we could mention, for example, there are certain drugs that people might have been given in days past, only to find out later that they cause birth defects in the next generation. Certain kinds of chemicals sprayed upon crops to get rid of bugs, found out that that contaminates the gene pool or something. So all these kinds of things happen, and so we know that sometimes people suffer because of a violation of natural law in some way. But finally, and I think this is perhaps what I want to emphasize the most tonight, in answering the question of the skeptic, if there's a good God, why does he allow suffering? We have to come back with, not only does he love us, not only did he create us with freedom of choice, and therefore others with freedom of choice, and some people make bad choices and so on and so on, but who's to say that suffering is always bad? Who gave us that clue? The atheist says, well, that's always the case. But is it really the case? And so let's talk about some benefits to suffering. And this is where the atheistic argument falls short. He assumes that all suffering is bad. But we know for a fact that sometimes suffering can help us. Like you touch a hot stove and it burns your finger, it teaches you to move your finger off that hot stove. And you're running a fever, it's a symptom to tell you that something's wrong in your body that needs attention. That kind of thing happens. Robert Browning wrote this comment. He said, I walked a mile with pleasure. She chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and never a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. True. And so in an article by Wayne Jackson, he mentions about 10 benefits to suffering. And I appreciate this. Found at on the Christian Courier website, Wayne Jackson is a, in my opinion, a great scholar of the Bible, a faithful gospel preacher, an excellent writer. But one thing we don't always know about him is that he has suffered cancer repeatedly in recent years. So he knows what suffering is like. And so he's writing from that perspective and says, what are the benefits of suffering? Number one, it is a reminder of our infirmity, that we are human beings, that we are not God. He said that pain can be humbling. In his words, he said it can slap the smart aleckness out of us. I thought that was a good way of saying it. The idea that we're just so smart, that we're just got everything figured out. Suffering can put you in a position of realizing your weakness. It also provides a reason for us to call upon the Lord. The psalmist said, in my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried out to my God. There's one inclination that human beings have. It is that when you suffer, you look up to God in prayer. And fortunately, some people, the only time they pray is when they're suffering or when something bad happens. And they expect God to drop everything immediately and solve their problem, when what they really need to do is turn their hearts to God and serve Him. In the third place, suffering gives us insight into the ugliness of sin. Go back to the garden, how sin came into the world, and the result of sin is death and all its companions. Sin separates us from our loving Creator. In the fourth place, suffering clarifies our values. It helps us to see what is really important in life. In the bed of suffering, you recognize things of greater importance than the things that we pay so close attention to in the here and now. John Dryden said, we by our sufferings learn to prize our bliss. In the fifth place, suffering is a seed of compassion. In fact, suffering prepares us to be compassionate to other people. An old proverb says one cannot comfort effectively until he is laid in the bed of suffering. Of Jesus, the Bible says, for since he himself was tempted in that which he suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. How come Jesus is such a great comforter? Because he went through what we go through. And he did so perfectly. In the sixth place, suffering has the benefit of making us homesick. If nothing more, suffering causes us to want heaven to a greater extent. This world is not our home. We're just passing through. Right here, according to 1 Peter, we are sojourners and pilgrims in this strange land. And the sufferings of this present life, Paul said, are not worthy to be compared to the glories that are to be revealed. Romans 8, verse 18. Paul wrote to Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 5, and he said that we are at home when we are with the Lord. Isn't that interesting? While we're here, we're not at home. But he used that figurative language to say, at home is with the Lord. That's where our home really is. In the seventh place, suffering has the benefit of teaching us how to pray. How to pray. Luke 11, verse 1, when the disciples said, Lord, teach us how to pray. These men had grown up in the Hebrew religion and the Jewish religion. They had been praying all their lives. They knew how to pray, but they could see something about how Jesus prayed, his intensity of prayer, his personal relationship with the Father, and they wanted to learn how to pray. If you want to learn to pray intensely, pray in that hour of suffering over and over again, constantly, heartbreaking in prayer. Jesus prayed, as it were, and sweated, as it were, sweat drops of blood. Not my will, but yours be done. In the eighth place, concerning the benefits of prayer, it grooms our soul for eternity. Concerning suffering, it grooms our soul for what is after this life. Precious metals are purified by going through the fire. Take a chunk of what looks like rock, put it into fire, and if it's the right kind of ore, it comes out as pure gold, and the impurities are smelted away, burned off. And what you have left is precious. And we are like that. Character doesn't happen by accident. It's built out of suffering. Number nine, as we talk about the benefit of suffering, suffering produces nobility. Courage is the one virtue of humanity that is most highly prized in many circles. We want to be people of courage. And conversely, cowardice is the one thing we want to avoid. We want to be courageous, not cowardly. But courage is the ability to face difficulty in spite of our fears, to do what is right no matter what. That's what courage is. But how could you possibly have courage where your faith is never tested? You would never have courage except for suffering, evil, and pain in the world around us. And finally, one benefit of suffering is it helps us to be real, to find out who we are. Paul spoke about Christians as wood, hay, and straw, or gold, silver, and costly stones. And the point he made there in 1 Corinthians 3 is that all will be tested by fire. Everyone will be tested by fire. Even as Jesus spoke about the parable of the sower went forth to sow, and some of the seed fell on this pathway, and it was eaten by the birds. Some fell in rocky soil, not much depth there. And he says then the heat of adversity, the sun is scorching heat, would come, and whatever plant was produced would wither in the sun. Everyone is going to be tested. Rain and sunshine will come into everyone's life. There will be blessings. There will be hardships. But it is the suffering part of that equation that tests our character, to refine it, to make it like gold and silver or costly stone. So I want to say to you that there is great value in suffering, if we use it appropriately. And that the presence of evil, pain, and suffering in the world today is not an indication that there is no God. It simply demonstrates that God has made us with the ability to choose. He has loved us enough to choose Him as opposed to serving ourselves or the devil. We have the choice of what we will or will not do. And tonight, as we consider these thoughts, if any of these things call to your mind a need that you have spiritually that we can help you with, either in obeying the gospel or perhaps in asking for the prayers of the church, we invite you to respond as we stand and as we sing together.